Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show is episode number 46, featuring my intriguing conversation with Margaret Pollock, the daughter of two Holocaust survivors who fell madly in love while in prison during World War II. Margaret shares how she learned about her parents' horrifying story of internment, why her parents were reluctant to discuss their experiences after the Holocaust, and what Margaret continues to do to further their legacy. As part of that legacy, Margaret was instrumental in bringing a traveling exhibit from the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam to the Moreno Valley Unified School District after there was a tragedy. Following Margaret's interview, you'll hear from Joseph Horowitz, a 13-year-old student at Landmark Middle School and docent at the traveling Anne Frank exhibit, currently in his community. As we kick off the third season of the podcast, I wanted to take a moment to thank you, our listeners, for the outcry of support that we received during the hiatus. I've received several calls and texts from my Freedom Writer teachers, so a special shout out is due to our most voracious listener, Freedom Writer teacher Karen Gibson from Maryland, expressing the urgency for the third season to commence. Well, Karen, the incredible guests we have lined up for this year's slate have stories that will leave you breathless. And I hope that this episode and every episode thereafter will leave you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. From the moment Carlos, one of my students, raised his hand and asked, "What is the Holocaust?" to the very first episode of his podcast featuring Holocaust survivor Renee Firestone, to recently the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, the Freedom Writer story has always been interwoven with Holocaust education. Margaret's parents were both Holocaust survivors, first imprisoned at Westerbork and finally at Bergen-Belsen. While interned, they shared notes with one another, falling in love in the midst of the madness. After surviving the war, Margaret's parents moved back to the Netherlands, married, and eventually moved to New York City, where they later founded the Anne Frank Center USA. With a soulful connection to the Holocaust, it was such a unique honor for the Freedom Writers to win the Spirit of Anne Frank Award from the Anne Frank Center USA, which was presented to them by Margaret's parents. Eagle-eyed viewers will recognize Margaret's father, Jack, in the ABC special on the Freedom Writers, conducted by correspondent Connie Chung, who happened to be a former podcast guest on episode number 41. Like many other families of Holocaust survivors, Margaret fell victim to the all-too-common culture of silence which precluded her parents from discussing this atrocity. It wasn't until Margaret was a teenager that she started to learn about her parents' story of them sharing notes, stealing pencils, and falling in love while interned at concentration camps during the Second World War. Margaret painstakingly translated over 100 of her parents' powerful letters, which she published in a book titled Steal a Pencil for Me. This poignant book was later adapted into a documentary of the same name, which is currently available on Netflix. Without further ado, here's my captivating conversation with Margaret Pollock. Jack Pollock stood at a microphone, looking out at a sea of freedom writers. They were seniors in high school. They had just won the Spirit of Anne Frank Award. And he told them very directly, very earnestly, about the power of learning from the past so we are not doomed to repeat it. And I'm sitting beside his beautiful, brilliant daughter, who is the epitome of taking the past and propelling our present. So I want to start with you, Margaret. As a child, having a father who was so wise, so prophetic, when was your first acknowledgement that your father was a Holocaust survivor?
It was not a defined identity being a Holocaust survivor in my house when I was little. I knew that my parents were Jewish. I knew that I was Jewish. And I just knew we had to tread lightly. And I was probably in seventh grade, and I took it upon myself to interview a local Auschwitz survivor. I swear I didn't correlate it as having anything to do with my childhood. It was just a paper I was going to do. And I think that was my first beginning of understanding that somehow it related to my life. And I had to get the courage to ask my parents because they would never have said anything to me. And my dad liked to go to soccer matches, and I could care less about soccer, but I wanted to go to a soccer game with my dad because I knew that was the best way to initiate a conversation. And I remember how nervous I was just to say, "Dad, I want to know what happened to you during the war." And I don't remember what he said, but I know the dialogue began then. And because I knew there were mysteries in our house, I was always digging through things, probably very inappropriately, looking in their drawers and looking at their papers. And, well, my dad's a hoarder, and he saved things that were meaningful to him. And at one point, I found a letter that my father had written to my mother that was loose in a drawer. And I knew enough Dutch to kind of piece together that it was terms of endearment, and the date was in the 1940s. And I asked my father, and I said, "What does this say? Can you translate it?" And it was this gorgeous love letter. And then the story came out. My father was married to another woman. They were having problems before the war, but they agreed to stay together for the duration of World War II because he knew that her fate would probably be quite dire if they didn't stay together. And he met my mom at a party right before he was deported to Westerbork and took one look at her and said, "That's the woman I should have married."
So I had this vision of your dad, humble at this party, seeing your mother, this va-va-vu, and she is striking and brilliant, like her daughter.
And from a famous family, too.
And so was there a reason that her family specifically delayed that process of being taken away from Amsterdam?
Well, my mom's family was on the very last transport out of Amsterdam to Westerbork, which I believe was September 1943. So you have to understand, the Germans invaded in 1940. It was a very slow process, very crafty process of making it seem like it's not so bad, you know, they've invaded and there's a few restrictions, and then the restrictions increase. They'll take away their radios, they'll take away their ability to go to the swimming pool, then they take away their jobs, then they take away where they live. But this was a 3-year process. My mother's father, as owner of a diamond factory and part of the Soup family, which next to the Oschers were the second biggest diamond manufacturers, was asked to become part of a group by the Germans called the Jewish Council. And the Jewish Council became a very hated group in Amsterdam because they thought they were trying to help and protect the Jewish population of Amsterdam. But they were manipulated like everybody else was to hand over the Jewish population. So all the records that they kept ended up being something they were deeply criticized for. And I think my grandfather survived the war, but I don't think he really survived the war. He lost his only son, my uncle Benno, and he was not well treated after war, which is one of the reasons that they came to America.
So I understand that your father was 10 years older than your mother. So your mother was 17, your father was 27, smitten and probably felt powerless. "I don't have the right economic wherewithal. I'm married. I can imagine how difficult that would have been for both of them to be these star-crossed lovers. You know, I'm a teacher of Romeo and Juliet, so I love this the star-crossed element. When was the first letter that your father wrote to her? Was this during the occupation?
No, it was in the camps because they had only met once at a mutual friend's birthday party, which was mostly younger people. And my mom remembers walking into the party and seeing my father's wife on someone else's lap. And she had heard about Japin Manja Polak and said, "That's funny, that's that couple. They don't look like they belong together at all." My father took one look at her and said, "That's the woman I should have married." But after that, that's it. My father can't stop thinking about her. He's in Westerbork. He's in a transit camp. He's in I think there were other camps in Holland, but this was where I believe 130,000 Dutch and German Jews were filtered through before they were sent to either Auschwitz or Sobibor or Theresienstadt or Birkenbelsen. And he's thinking about her, and he knows that she's likely going to be on that last transport that comes with all the diamond merchants and their families, and figures out how to get transferred to the barrack that my mother's going to be in with his wife.
So for our younger listeners, Anne Frank and her family were taken to Westerbork. So let's go back to Westerbork, and suddenly your father realizes, there's that pretty girl I should have married. And what is that like for these star-crossed lovers now to be powerless but have the power of the pencil? What was that like to be able to communicate? And the longevity of this first note becoming 130 notes.
There were a lot more than 130 notes. My mother's letters to my father were mostly lost. There's about 10 that survived the war. They exchanged letters towards the very end because they didn't know what would happen to each other. They were not going to be on the same transports out of Bergen-Belsen when the liberation was close, and they didn't know if they'd be liberated or killed. And they wanted to exchange letters. Number one, my mother was afraid what would happen if her family found all of his love letters to her, because they would not have approved, and she really kept it clandestine and secret. But the letters are letters of passion, of despair, of hope, of concern, occasional rifts in the relationship, because my father's wife, if she didn't have a crush on someone else in the camp, then she'd start objecting to their relationship.
This is amazing.
Part of the issue with me was when I discovered this grand romance, as Aaron, you're all excited and titillated, and I don't blame you. It's so cool, and it's so romantic. And then as I got a little older, while I was translating them, the real story behind it seeped in, you know. My mother's brother, Benno, was murdered in Mauthausen, where the stories say they beat the young men, especially those with glasses. And I always see these pictures of Benno with glasses. My father's mom and dad were gassed in Sobibor. My father gave his father his good pair of shoes because he thought he was going to a labor camp. So at the cattle car, he gave him his best shoes that he needed so that his father would do okay when he got there. But and the beauty of their story, the yang to the yin, was the horror.
I've known you for years. You are the ultimate empath. So I think it's ironic that there's so much about your story that is metaphors and analogies. And one of the reasons I was so excited to have you as a guest is I think in these very troubling times where people are made to feel that they're an other, their roots are vilified, and our boundaries and borders, we shut them and say no more. You were privileged to be the child of refugees seeking something better. And being able to be the American dream, whatever that dream is that you got to actualize, what is that like to be the child of people who came to our shores through Ellis Island to reinvent themselves and be the beneficiary of that, and realize that a lot of people don't want that to continue for others?
That's a lot of questions, because to grow up the child of refugees, of others, as a child, it means you're different. You feel different. I just couldn't put together the world I was living in, the world and the world that my parents came from. I knew I loved it and cherished it and was proud of it for them, but I also knew they were broken.
Was there things that you wanted to be more Americanized and were ashamed of your parents' roots? Because I think a lot of kids can relate to that.
I never felt ashamed because my parents were pretty spectacular people, and they glittered to me.
My father was such an optimist, and my mother was so elegant and beautiful. They were almost untouchable to me in some ways. And I saw that other people felt that way about them too. And I didn't want to impose on them. They sent me to a summer camp, and I went for 3 years, even though I was teased and bullied like you wouldn't believe. Locked out of the bunk, naked, comet thrown on my head in the bathroom, that kind of thing. They had no idea because I knew it was expensive. And I knew they had worked really hard to send me there, so they never knew a thing. So I didn't, there was no shame at who they were. I felt more shame at who I was. And I think it had to do with me taking in the pain underneath their beautiful veneers. Mm. And I couldn't reconcile how to fix something that to other people didn't look broken. And I know that's probably different from a lot of other immigrants and refugees, but it is the same. They just had a different front.
So for any refugee from a war-torn country, a genocide, the PTSD that they must experience probably is passed down to their kids. So can you give examples of maybe times that you might have noticed how they tried to mask PTSD, or if there was something that was very evident?
There was lots of evidence of that. With me, huge fear about me even going outside to play. I had a lot of limits on my activities, and it was just more about safety than it was about them not wanting me to go have fun or be with people. I just felt it was risky. So I was very tense all the time in terms of what could happen to me, because I don't think they could bear loss. They wouldn't travel together on an airplane. They wanted to make sure that one of them would survive should something happen. And those words were said a lot, if something happens, if something happens. Cuban Missile Crisis came along. We're sitting around a table listening to a little radio. My father calls and has a bomb shelter built in our house. And I just remember a lot of fear and terror. When there was a blackout, it was the end of the world. And then there was also, my mom had fears about people knowing we were Jewish. It was a compliment to someone who didn't look Jewish, who we knew who was Jewish. When it came time for the holidays, other Jewish families would put the Hanukkah candles in their window, and my mom would say, "You don't advertise." So there was worries about that.
I want to talk about, at the time, was the word survivor or victim? Because I know a lot of survivors think the word survivor is empowering, where a victim is something that's so negative. So before you had the courage to ask, did other people know that your parents were survivors?
It just wasn't talked about. I think it was in the mid-60s, there was a mini-series on television called Holocaust. And I remember my parents being blown away that someone actually wanted to make a fictional story about an aspect of what they went through. When the movie came out about them, I had so many people contact me from my childhood saying, "I had no idea."
Tell our listeners the name of the book that then became the name of the documentary. It's so clever and profound.
It had a bunch of names, but I wanted to find something in the letters that said what the book was about. And one of the lines, when my father was working in a kitchen, my mom was going to 2 a.m. meetings with the Germans, trying to teach them the diamond trade, because the Jews were the only one that knew the diamond business. And the Germans actually had a little diamond factory on a track outside of Bergen-Belsen where they were going to set it up to get a template going for them once they were, had killed all the Jews. And my father asked her in a letter to please steal a pencil for me. And she did. And the title of the book and the documentary is also "Steal a Pencil for Me" and the opera.
So I love that line, "Steal a pencil for me." The simplicity of that writing utensil is anything but simple. It was probably the most liberating thing your father owned, besides the very words he wrote.
it was a lifeline. And it was a lifeline for them, because especially in Belsen, at one point they were split into different camps because there were different compounds and areas, and they were separated, and notes would have to go through wire fences, and it was their lifeline with each other. And sometimes they wrote and weren't able to get the letters to each other, but they'd hold on to it till they could send a group in a bundle. Almost like anyone, you know, if you're communicating with someone who's incarcerated, there's no, you don't know exactly what's going to reach someone, you know?
So there was another young girl in your life that wasn't in your life, by the name of Anne Frank, Dutch. And as we know, she doesn't survive. When was your first realization that you would have this relationship with Anne Frank for the remainder of your life?
I believe I read the book when I was a young teen, which means I would have read it when I told you I didn't know what my parents went through. So none of that correlates in my mind. But Anne was in the same Montessori school as my mother. She knew vaguely who Anne was. She knew better who her older sister Margot was. And my father gathered with some other Dutch survivors in 1977 and organized the Anne Frank Center USA, working alongside both the Anne Frank House and the Anne Frank Fonds, which Otto Frank started. But I don't think it was honestly until about 13 years ago, when I was with my mother and father in Amsterdam. My father was in his 90s already, and they took my daughter Sophie and me to meet Miepries, who hid Anne Frank and was 100 years old, that somehow I felt a part of. I think I had to be in the Anne Frank House with my mother and father to understand that this is them and this is me and we are one.
So for young readers that may not have read The Diary of Anne Frank yet, share a little bit about why Miep is so iconic. For those that have seen the feature film Freedom Riders, there's a famous actress, Pat Carroll, who plays Miepkies in the film, but Miepkies has such a special role in the preservation of a story. So explain that to young folks who haven't got their first copy of Anne Frank.
There's a term called righteous Gentile that's used about the human beings in Europe during World War II who risked their lives to help the persecuted of Hitler. So Miep was a righteous Gentile, and the penalty for hiding a Jew was death. If she'd been discovered as the secretary in the location where the Frank family and the Van Damme family and the Dussel family were in an attic, not being able to move a peep all day long while people were working in the factory downstairs in case someone heard them moving in terror and fear, Miep came and brought them food during off hours. Miep came and told them when there was danger and when they had to be extra quiet. And she did what she felt was right. It wasn't because she loved Jews, it's because she loved human beings, and she felt that no one should have to endure these families were enduring in this very tight space in this very little attic. And when the Nazis finally figured out that these families were hiding in this attic in the middle of the most beautiful part of Amsterdam, she found a little checkered red and white book that was with a clip to it, and kept it safe so that if anyone came back, they could have Anne's book.
The ironic twist that Otto was the sole survivor of his family and the eight that were in the attic, and because of me taking this checkered journal, it led to the publication. So it was a father honoring a daughter. You were the daughter honoring the parents. You translated the letters, you bound the letters. This book is, you can't put this book down. So I love that you honored their story in a way.
Have I told you another part of my family connection to Anne?
Keep telling us.
My father has a sister named Betty who's still alive. Not only was she hidden in the same room that our friend Jan Erik was born in, after the war, Betty had a very precious job in the agriculture business, and Secretary of Agriculture had the power to release paper for publications. And paper was very scarce after the war. And Ani Romain contacted Betty and said, I hid you during the war. I have a dear friend who wants to get his daughter's diary published, and you have access to the Ministry of Agriculture. You owe me. I want you to go and make this happen.
So your Aunt Betty?
My Aunt Betty went to the Minister of Agriculture and said, I know what you did during the war. You will release paper to publish my friend's daughter's diary. I never told you that.
No. So the first school that you were instrumental in getting this incredible Anne Frank exhibit to had great loss. A teenager, a young boy at 13, lost his life. And the kids are reeling. And the gift of that tender age, you know, Anne Frank was given a diary at 13. You started being inquisitive at 13. The young boy we're interviewing is 13. For those that are not Jewish, describe to our listeners the power of the age of 13 in the Jewish faith. What is that symbolism? Because I'm seeing the pattern here of 13 with Anne and yourself and this sweet young boy.
So the sweet young boy you've met and the sweet young boy who didn't make it past 13. And Anne who barely made it past 13. 13 in Jewish religion is the age you become an adult. There's the bar mitzvah for the boy and the bat mitzvah for the girl. And you learn the language in Hebrew. And you learn a big patch of prayers. And you're required to do your own commentary like a preacher or a minister would do. And then you are celebrated by your family and your friends. Maybe hundreds of years ago, 13-year-olds really did have to act like adults. And we don't have to now. And yet, it's beautiful to give someone the dignity to understand that I am an adult now, and that gives me responsibility. And I have to act with ethics and morals and begin to understand what it's going to take to make it on my own in the world. But it's just a beginning. It's the first steps towards that. And it's a time of confusion, but if you're given that power of responsibility, maybe you're less confused because there's bylaws and guidelines. And I'm not talking about Judaism. In life, there are ways to function as you turn into an adult that will serve you. And you can educate a 13-year-old how to do that.
I'm holding your parents' book, and I'm wondering if you would select a paragraph or passage and show the flavor of this beautiful love story.
Yes. Here's a nice one. Monday, January 3rd, 1944. This was my mom's birthday. She's 21. My very dear little darling. I really should leave out the word little on your birthday, as someone who is as old as you should not be addressed as such. But nevertheless, I think I will keep calling you that until your 100th birthday. How old will I be by then? I'm writing this little epistle on my bed. My handwriting is almost more illegible than usual. You are starting a new year just as I started a new year a few days ago. What it will bring, we still do not know. But if you look into the future with as much confidence, hope, and optimism as I do, I am convinced that the new year will bring for us the happiness that we both yearn for. Don't look at obstacles as if they are all black. I continue to feel very badly that the circumstances for us, more specifically for you, are different than in the beginning of our being together here in Westerbork. But here too, I believe that God is with us. The foundation has been laid, the rest we will catch up with in Amsterdam. And as long as we keep daily contact, I'm satisfied. Not satisfied in the sense that I think it's sufficient,
but you understand what I mean. My darling, my very best wishes on this very special day, as turning 21 is something special. Let's hope to be able to celebrate both our birthdays next year in different circumstances and together. An extra birthday kiss, Yap.
More. I want more.
I'm just picking what I've marked here for whatever reason. My dear, dear little Yap, this morning I received two letters from you. I really enjoyed your sermons. They were so wonderful, except for your food stories, which I found offensive. We were all very angry that you talked about chicken noodle soup when all we get are groats and turnips. I can tell from the tone of your letter that you're still quite strong and that you make the best of our pathetic life here. And that gives me such unbelievable pleasure. That is the most important strength for our race to the finish line. Last night, we women had a one-hour quarantine bath. All blankets and clothing that you own must go into the truck and be deloused. This morning, I found my last two house lice dead in my sweater. I can't tell you how lucky I feel to be rid of them. But for how long? We sleep underneath Bill, and we don't know how much longer he'll be sick, and we know nothing about this quarantine bath in relationship to our next transport. We've heard nothing. My darling boy, I'm going to do something very important. Eat. We had a surprise today. A beet soup with a potato and bread. We are old and decrepit and so hungry. My sense of humor is dying. Maybe I'll write more this afternoon. My dear darling, I am now lying on my bed feeling wonderful with my face in the sun, and I feel satisfied about this day. Think of when we will be able to go out at night together. When will it happen for the first time, darling? Everybody is crazy here because of the inspection committee. I can't wait to see what will happen. Darling, try to steal me a pencil from somewhere. You with your great contacts may be able to obtain such a thing. Did you know that I'm really proud of you? That you do everything so well. So, my girl, after this short talk, I must start working again. I have to study the Dutch language, which I have to teach to the boys tomorrow. In any case, it is very nice that all the boys in my shoe group want this. Darling, I hope till tonight, otherwise definitely till tomorrow. Many, many kisses and love. Yap. My father worked tearing the soles of shoes, which probably had come from the extermination camps where they recycled them in his camp. And he would teach the young boys, probably the German kids, the Dutch language.
Taking your father's words in a camp during a war, and like the optimism and hope, and let's talk about that. What does that teach our listeners about present circumstances and things that are bleak, having hope at the end of it?
Some of us are wired to be doom and gloomy about things. Some of us are wired to push forward no matter what. I really pray that one can learn to understand that however bad things are, it passes. There are good times and there's bad times in life. And part of the maturing process is learning how to roll with it and saying, I can lift myself out of this darkness. I can hope and be satisfied with the little bit that I have working towards having the things I dream of. And seeing a little flower come out of the ground when everything else is rubble and dirt. There's something beautiful to see in everything.
One of the ways that we conclude our podcast is by asking the guests to pay it forward or to challenge or to honor. And I think what's so apropos with this episode is it's honoring you and your work. It's honoring your parents and their legacy. So I'd love for you to maybe challenge young people who may have a similar beginning like you. Maybe they're still feeling bullied or othered, or maybe they're still trying to grapple with the courage to ask their parents, how and why did you come to the country we live in now? So what could you say in honor of this incredible journey that you were on?
Do you know how many kids at your age, even ones you look at and think they've got it all, sit in complete doubt of who they are, of what they can be, of the lack of possibilities in your life? But there are people you can read about who at your age discovered their common humanity with people they view as winners and as losers, and understood that each of us has a really special gift. What is your gift? What is your art form? What are your mathematical skills? What is your passion? And if you don't have your passion, get excited about finding your passion. Explore in a way that's not going to hurt you, that's going to empower you. Find good mentors. Who do you respect? Don't be afraid to go to them and learn to work towards peace. My father would end every speech with his 6 lessons of the Holocaust. Don't discriminate. Don't generalize. Don't be a bystander. Work for peace. Enjoy the simple things in life. And we are living in a wonderful country. And we all need to work together to make this a better world, which can be achieved if people learn the lessons of the Holocaust.
I'm so grateful to our guest, Margaret Pollack, for sharing her parents' incredible story. Margaret is now the co-founder of Anne Frank LA, which continues to further her parents' legacy of sharing Holocaust education with students in need. We now have a special segment from Joseph Horowitz, a student from Landmark Middle School in Moreno Valley. Margaret's help in bringing this amazing traveling Anne Frank exhibit to Southern California was essential to its success. And thanks to her phenomenal support and the incredible partnerships between the Anne Frank House, the Moreno Valley Unified School District, and the Friedemeyer's Foundation, students from Landmark Middle School were given the unique opportunity to guide students through the life and legacy of Anne Frank. In the fall of 2019, Landmark Middle School suffered a great loss when a 13-year-old student, Diego, lost his life. The Traveling Anne Frank exhibit was an amazing opportunity for the surviving students to rewrite their narrative and become upstanders rather than bystanders. The Traveling Anne Frank exhibit was not just informative, but it was transformative for these young students. It was particularly meaningful for our guest, Joseph. As a Jewish child in the foster care system, Joseph feels a strong connection to Anne Frank and knows how important it is for everyone to learn about the lessons of the Holocaust. I was humbled to meet Joseph while he was being trained to become a docent for the exhibit, and I'm so excited for you to see his transformation as he helps us facilitate the exhibit's transition to other schools in his district.
Hello, I'm Joseph Horowitz, and I'm 13 and in the 8th grade. I'm Jewish, and my great-grandfather, he experienced the horrors of World War II and all of the atrocities committed by the Nazis. His whole family on his side died in the Holocaust, mainly at Auschwitz and other camps in Poland. And on my great-grandmother's side, half of her family died in the Holocaust. So I have a very personal connection with this, and I'd like to reteach this and educate my fellow peers and a lot more people, so that way something like that never happens again, even whether it be to the Jews or any other religion or race. Growing up as a foster kid, it's come with some name-calling too. Like, if for some reason, some people don't know the difference between orphan and foster care, so I've been called an orphan sometimes. But otherwise, I've had pretty good foster parents so far, and my current foster parents, I adore them. They're nice and loving, and they treat me like a son. Early on, like elementary school, I was called a dirty Jew, a kike, a Christ killer, stuff like that. And it's followed me to even to 8th grade. I mean, I'm still called a dirty Jew sometimes. You know, some people make fun and say, at least my family didn't die in the Holocaust type stuff. I've had a bad foster parent. She was my second one. It wasn't good there. I mean, she would stereotype me. She would make fun of me for the fact that I am Jewish. and other stuff. She would like poke fun and, you know, that eats away at you. But it kind of overlapped. Like, now not only am I considered a dirty Jew, it's also, oh, you're a foster kid, so that means you're bad, or it's something you did wrong. And that's what I've heard a lot, too, from other people. Stereotyping about foster kids and stuff like that. I had no quarrel with these people, and it kind of came out of nowhere. You learn to accept that there is people like that in this world, and maybe by retelling the story, so, you know, more, less people like that exist, and there's more love and compassion around. That's why I'm doing this, so that that there can be less of that. There will always be stereotypes and name-calling and stuff like that, but maybe I can help in reduce that number, prejudice and discrimination and stereotyping. Anne Frank program is basically just about educating the youth and retelling the stories of the Holocaust and Anne Frank so that way it's not forgotten. First, we were trainees, and then we became, you know, the tour guides for the exhibit at our school. It was reassuring knowing that, like, I'm teaching something that will be passed on to the next generation and the next generation that can prevent horrible things like the Holocaust and stuff like that happening again. So if I had the chance to take the people who called me names to the exhibit, I would, because even if it's going to help a small bit to change some of the people who called me those names' minds, then, you know, I'm still for that chance because, you know, even though it's a small bit, it still could change some things. Because if you don't know about the butterfly effect, one small action could trigger a whole series of events. So maybe that small action helps trigger something good. I think doing this, and this reflects on being an upstander. So although there was a lot of people who did side with Hitler during his time in being chancellor and then moving up to dictator and all of his actions, there was a lot of people who supported him, but there was also people who didn't support him, those upstanders who were against. And that gets into the topic that happened here. So obviously, if you don't know, there was a fight that resulted in the death of a boy named Diego. And there were a lot of bystanders. And so maybe, just maybe, if someone intervened or if someone would have stepped up and said, hey, break it up, you know, I still might be able to say hi to him. Love and compassion need to be spread more. Being an upstander helps spread that. Maybe you helping out someone, lifting them off their feet, helps them lift other people off their feet. An act of kindness can lead to hundreds of acts of kindness, and that hundreds could lead to thousands and millions and billions. I think more people are equipped to say, hey, stop, that's wrong, or break it up after seeing what happened with Diego and after going through the exhibit, because they know a simple act like that can help stop a lot of people hurting. Be an upstander, don't be a bystander, because the last thing we need is more bystanders.
My dear listeners, on the heels of the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz concentration camp, may we revel in our common humanity. May we all remember to work towards peace. And as our guest Margaret Pollack reminds us, may we create a better world by learning the lessons of the Holocaust. That concludes our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. Once again, I'm your host, Erin Gruel. This episode was produced and edited by Matt Martin Hall and Rob Falk. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.